So, but this morning I want to talk to you about Father's Day, and that invokes all kinds of emotions. For some of us, we have great fathers, and so we can't wait to get done today to go to our brides or whatever you're going to do. So you can hug your father and say, I love you, I honor you, I'm so glad that out of the whole world, God allowed you to be my father. I'm so glad about that. And for some of us, that's our story. But for others, that is not. And so the question is how do we honor our father if he's not honorable? It's one thing. Is it what if he was a mongrel, or what if I love the way the Afrikaans people have certain words that have rings to it. I love it, like palooka. I love that. Like, what if your dad was a palooka? What do you do then? Well, a couple of thoughts on that. One, you honor people because you're honorable, never because they are. That's one. So you honor someone because you're honorable, not because they're honorable. Two, honor has almost nothing to do with what you say to a person, but it has everything to do with how you behave away from that person. If you are a parent of a teenager, you understand this. It would bless your heart if your teenager said, you know, mom, dad, whatever, I just want you to know I honor you as my parents. That would bless your heart. But what blesses you more is to know that when they're out with their friends, that they're living in a way that honors your name when you can't see them, than it has anything to do with what you say to them. If your father was a palooka, the best way to honor your father is to choose to live a godly life as an adult. And when people look at your life, they will assume that your father was a godly man, even though he wasn't. The best way to bring honor to your father's name is to change your family tree for the better, starting right now. And if you start right now, one day you could be the hero of your entire family tree, because somebody has to do it. And it's a good thing Ezekiel deals with this very thing in quite frankly, one of the most revolutionary ways ever. Now, before we get to the passage, I want to introduce some terminology to you, because when you read ancient literature, you have to ask yourself, who wrote it? Who was it written to? How did they take it at the time? You can't put 2016 white people definitions over the top of ancient Middle Eastern concepts and expect to get it right. And there's some language Ezekiel uses that if we don't know how they used it at the time, we might think he's talking about heaven and hell. But he's not talking about heaven and hell at all. As a matter of fact, the concept of hell as we know it did not exist in Ezekiel's day. That doesn't mean it's not true. It just means it didn't exist when Ezekiel wrote it. So he couldn't have been thinking it, right? The concept of heaven as we know it did not exist in Ezekiel's day either. So these words have nothing to do with heaven and hell. Let me show them to you now, if you could bring that first slide up. The first one is light, life, and increase. Now, light, life, and increase have nothing to do with going to heaven when we die. It has everything to do with descriptions of a way of life that leads to abundance, favor, and multiplied blessings. In Scripture, it's tied to a choice to live in God's ways. So living in life, life in one sense is literal, like you are living. In another sense, it's metaphorical. It's a choice. I set before you today life and death, blessings and curses. Choose life that you might live. Choose to be in the light as he is in the light. These things have nothing to do with heaven and hell. It has everything to do with how you're living right now. And they use three words synonymously: light, life, and increase. The antonym to that, the opposite, was death, darkness, decrease. Hit that next one. Death, darkness, and decrease is descriptions of a way of life that leads to disrepair or unraveling of completion. So in one sense, you have things that lead your life to wholeness, let's say it that way, and in another sense, you have things that lead your life to disrepair. If you think about sin as right and wrong, you can always rationalize your way out of something. But if you think about it as light or dark, that is totally different, and it doesn't let you off the hook. The question isn't, is it right or wrong? The question is, does it lead your life to the best possible place? Or does it lead your life to something that unravels you? It brings you to disrepair. So when Ezekiel says things like the soul that sins is the soul that will die. He's not talking about people who sin automatically go to hell. He's talking about when you choose to live outside of God's ways, it brings your life to disrepair. But if you choose to live in God's ways, it brings your life to light, life, and increase, or wholeness. Now, with that as a bit of the background, let's read the passage. Here it goes. This is Ezekiel 18, verse 1. And the word of the Lord came to me, saying, what do you people mean by quoting this proverb about the land of Israel? The fathers eat sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge. As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, you will no longer quote this proverb to me in Israel. Now that's an odd thing to say, isn't it? I don't want to hear this proverb ever again. The fathers eat sour grapes, so the children's teeth are set on edge. I don't want to hear that come out of your mouth one more time. Essentially, it's God saying, I'm sick of hearing that. And if you're a parent, you understand that. There's been times where your child is going on and on and on and on, and you can't take one more second of it. So you say, I don't want to hear this come out of your mouth one more time. The fathers eat sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge. I never want to hear that come out of your mouth one more time. Now that's odd, so we have to ask ourselves, what did it mean when they said it? How did they take it at the time? Quick history lesson to understand what that proverb meant and why it was written. There was a guy named Abraham. Abraham had a son named Isaac. Isaac then had a son named Jacob. Jacob had 12 children. Those 12 children, because of famine, ended up settling in Egypt. Those 12 children had babies. And then those babies had more babies. And then those babies had more babies. And then that generation had more babies. And then they multiplied and multiplied and multiplied until they became threatening to the Egyptians. So the Egyptians enslaved them. Years later, a guy named Moses comes along, empowered by God, to free them from slavery into liberation. And it works. They end up in freedom in a place called the Promised Land. Now, these people came from freed slaves. And God tells them, I want you to show the whole world what it's like if I'm in charge of your kingdom. So the kings of Israel were supposed to, quote, maintain justice and righteousness for the poor and the afflicted. And Saul sort of did that. David did that very well. Solomon did a really poor job at that. In 1 Kings 10, it says that this is the account of the slave labor that Solomon forced to build the temple to the Lord. So here was the irony. A guy that comes from a lineage of slavery actually turns out that he's forcing slaves to build the temple to honor the Lord, who's a slave liberator. And he failed to see the irony in that. God says, no, you haven't learned your lesson. And they end up back in slavery. So Ezekiel is a prophet or priest who was taken as a slave in Babylon under the reign of King Jehoiakim. These people had a very bad day. If you were under the age of 8, the Babylonians took you by the feet and bashed your head against stones. Your women became sexual property instantaneously. If you were over the age of 30, you were killed because you were useless and old. If you were under the age of 30, but over the age of 8, they wanted your muscles for slavery, but they didn't want you to be able to procreate, so they held you down and they crushed your testicles with 2 stones. It was a very, very, very bad day. These people then... Which, by the way, if you're one of these people who say, oh, can you believe how bad this world's getting? Get a life, read a history book. This world's getting better and better and better. So these people who were God's chosen people find themselves in slavery in Babylon. And instead of taking responsibility for their part in it, they all blamed Solomon because Solomon's policies were seen as what angered God. And they actually wiped Solomon's name from history records for hundreds of years. They refused to call him Solomon. They simply called him David's son. It was sort of like, yeah, David's son. You know the one we're talking about. It was that. Which is why the prophets Isaiah, Daniel, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, when they're speaking to the captives in Babylon, they use use words like take heart, for God is going to bring a new son of David to maintain justice and righteousness, which is why in Jesus's life, most people called him Jesus son of Jesus son of Joseph, or Jesus son of God even, but the poor and the afflicted called him Jesus son of David, have mercy on me. In other words, if you're the one the prophet spoke about, then you're here to maintain justice and righteousness for me. You are the son of David, who is supposed to be the new son of David, who's supposed to maintain justice and righteousness to the poor. So because they blamed Solomon, they made up songs blaming Solomon for their plight in life. And one of the proverbs they made up was, it's because my father ate sour grapes that my teeth are set on edge. In other words, my life is bitter today, not because of anything I did, but because of the decisions my father made. My father ate sour grapes, so it sets my teeth on edge. And God says, I don't want to hear that one more day. If God was Afrikaans, he would have said, "Bly still." Not one more second. That is not empowering at all. Here's what's happening in this passage. The current generation is blaming the previous generation for where they are in life. That's not relevant at all, is it? My dad was a horrible, drunken, abusive man, so I'll be a horrible, a drunken, abusive man. And if anyone ever confronts me on, why are you a horrible, drunken, abusive man? I'll just say, it's because my dad was a horrible, drunken, abusive man. My father ate sour grapes, so it sets my teeth on edge. My mom was a critical, cantankerous, horrible woman that forced my dad to pray every night for a comet to come to Earth to bring him sweet relief from her. So I'll be a critical, cantankerous, horrible woman who yells and screams and demeans. My father ate sour grapes, so it sets my teeth on edge. My parents made destructive choices, so I'll make destructive choices. My parents gave me nothing to start with. That's why I'm broke. I'm not broke because I spend money I don't have to buy things I can't afford to impress people I don't like. No, I'm not broke because I'm a financial palooka. No, I'm broke because my parents never gave me something to start with. This is something that even though it's 3,000 years old, it is very much alive in our culture. My father ate sour grapes, so it set my teeth on. Generation. End of yes. And the current generation then blames the previous generation for their lot in life. You say, Shane, you understand, my family had issues. Really? Everybody's family has issues. Let me ask you a question. Did your family include a man and a woman trying to live together? Then there's issues. I mean, marriage is so complicated, and so the Bible can't even agree on it. Solomon says, if you find a wife, you find a good thing. Paul says, he who marries does not sin, but he signed up for a life of pain. Why? Because men and women are different. Even with preferences, they're different. Language, they're different. Women say, I have nothing to wear. A man hears a woman say, I have nothing to wear, and he looks in the closet, and you say, you got a closet full of nothing to wear, right? But every woman in the room knows when a woman says, I have nothing to wear, what she means is I have nothing new. So if a woman said to another woman, I have nothing to wear, she'd say, girl, let's go shopping. That's what we need to do. But men don't talk like that. If a man says, I have nothing to wear, what he means is I have nothing clean. Please, somebody do laundry. Two totally different things.
Your family had issues? Of course they had issues. Men and women don't talk well together. The studies show that women, in general, self-deprecate to get a compliment. So a woman cooks a meal, and she's not sure about it, so she tastes it, and she's not sure about it, so she says, "This is the worst meal I've ever cooked." And what she's looking is for the man to go, "Oh, no, this is awesome." But that's not what he does. This good-hearted man who's trying to help, he goes, "No, it's not." Your family had issues? Of course they had issues. Women say, "Can you believe how much weight I gained over the holidays? Can you believe how much weight I gained over the holidays?" Men don't know what to do with that, so they just click. Even things like preferences, like smells. Women love sweet-smelling things. They love it. Perfume, flowers. You buy a woman a thing of flowers, what's the first thing she does? Sniffs it. You buy a man a bouquet of flowers, the only thing he sniffs is $70. That's it. He's like, "Man, what did that cost?" Women love sweet-smelling things, perfumes, candles. Two women can go to a candle shop for an hour, sniff wax, and call it fun. That is weird. You'll never see two men doing that. You imagine that? You imagine walking by a candle shop and seeing two men in there sniffing wax? Imagine that? "Hey, Billy, check that out. That's that new white lilac scent, man. That is something special. I'm going to tell you something right now." No chance. Women love sweet-smelling things. Men, on the other hand, love stinky things. Nothing's funnier to a man than when something stinky happens. It's hilarious. Women think that's disgusting. And men have this code. Maybe this will help you understand you women. Maybe this will help you understand your man. Men have a code. I don't know what to call it, so we'll call it the code of the stinky thing. Because here's the thing. If a group of men are playing rugby, and it's out there, and they're sweaty and dirty and nasty and muddy and whatever, and then they finish their rugby match, and they've got to get to a meeting, so they shower quickly, and they put these nasty, dirty, sweaty, bloody, muddy clothes in a plastic bag. They seal the bag up and put it in the boot of their car. 3 months later, they're looking for something in the boot of the car. And then they see the bag, right? Every man in this room knows what has to happen next. You have to. If you know what's in that bag and it's been in there 3 months, you got to see what it smells like now. So here's what happens. You have to. It's irresistible. We love it. So you undo the plastic bag and you, whoo, wait, now here's the thing. Here's the code of the man. If I have any of my male friends around, they owe me a courtesy sniff of my stinky thing. So you pass it around. And everybody goes, oh, right? And if they smell my stinky thing, then next time they have a stinky thing, then I owe them a courtesy sniff of their stinky thing. So they did a courtesy sniff of my stinky thing, and now I owe them a courtesy sniff of their stinky thing. That's why, if you're ever caught in traffic, right, and there's four guys in a car, and three of them have their head out the window, and the fourth guy's in the back seat laughing, he just cashed in on his courtesy sniff. Your family had issues? Of course they did. A person in your family likes stinky things. Another person likes sweet-smelling things. How are they supposed to get along? They talk different. They act different. They prefer different things. You say, "Shade, you understand, my dad had issues." Of course your dad had issues. Everybody's dad has issues. Everybody. Some, granted, far more severe than others. My dad's a good dad, but he had issues. My dad loved scaring us. Loved it. He thought it was hilarious. And I'm not talking about sort of scaring people. I'm talking about flipping, well, terrifying them. My dad is an early morning person. When I was a kid, he got up at 5:30. By high school, it was 5:15. But by the time I was in high school, it was 4:30. I was in college, it's 4:15. I was talking to him the other day, and he said, "Shane, I'm thinking about starting to get up at 4. And I said, "Dad, if you live 10 more years, you're going to have to eat breakfast the night before." Well, I mean, honestly. And that's a terrifying combination when he loves to scare you, because I used to have this bad habit. I'm a night person. I don't get up early, right? So I used to, my mom would come in and shake me awake in the morning and then sit me up on the side of the bed. And I would just sit on the side of the bed and fall back asleep. So Dad decided one day he's going to break me of that. And what he did is he hid under my bed. Now, My mom had no idea. So she shakes me awake, sits me up. Now, let me be clear about this. I was seven, all right? I think the boogeyman lives under my bed anyway, right? And so I'm there on the side of the bed, and I was just about to fall asleep. And my dad reached out and grabbed my feet. Your dad had issues? One day he decided to scare me. I had a closet that opened like this. And so what he did, because he got up so early, he put himself in there, and he put himself in the form of a crucifix, right? And so it's like 6 o'clock, and I get up, and I'm trying to choose, you know, what I'm going to wear. And I open the closet door, and I look up, and there's my dad in the form of a crucifix. Your dad had issues? He also liked to embarrass us. There was one time he was dropping me off for junior high camp. Yes, you heard me right. 13-year-old camp, right? 100 and something of us going to camp. I'm talking about two full buses full of 13-year-olds, right? So he pulls me up and he says, hey, buddy. He says, I hope camp goes well. I hope God does something in your heart. I'm going to pray for you every single day that God's going to do something awesome in your heart. I love you very, very much. Have a good time at camp. I said, thanks, Dad. I love you too. And I went to get out of the car. He said, wait a minute. Where's my kiss by? I said, Dad, not here. It's all my friends are here. Like, no, let's not do that. And he goes, okay, I get that. That's no worries. Get on out. So I got on out, handed my bag to the bus driver, get on the bus. Full bus full of 13-year-olds. We're just fixing to go. And I look up, and to my horror, my father had decided to get on the bus. He pulled his shorts up to here, his black socks up to here, and he was walking like this. He grabbed the microphone of the bus and he said, this bus isn't leaving until my Shaney Wayne, he comes up here and gives me a kiss. The whole bus started chanting, kiss him, kiss him. Your dad had issues. Everybody's dad has issues. Everybody's family has issues. Here's the thing, right? I have a master's degree in clinical psychology. I used to be a licensed professional counselor. I don't want to do that anymore. That's why I didn't renew my license, because I got tired of listening to people. But here's the thing. I'm skilled enough that if I sit with you and ask you the right question and you're honest, I can tell you why you are the way you are. Okay, your dad was this way. I can see how you became this certain way. Your mom was this way. I can see why you've turned out this sort of way. I can always tell you why you are the way you are. But here's the problem with that. You're 40. And it doesn't help you to know why you are the way you are. The question is, what are you going to do about it now? Are you going to live the rest of your life feeling predetermined because my father ate sour grapes, now I'm going to live on edge the rest of my life? Or are you going to stand on your own two feet and say, as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. I'm going to quit rationalizing things that are destructive, and I'm going to change my life. The only way that your father is why you are the way you are is if you're 8, because then you have no control. But by 25, you ought to be making a decision, drawing a line in the sand that says, regardless of my father eating sour grapes, I'm going to eat fresh fruit the rest of my life. I am not going to repeat that because I don't have to. Ezekiel is handling something revolutionary. In that day, common sense was that if your father was an evil man, you had to pay for the sins of your father. That was the common sense of the day. Where'd they get that from? Deuteronomy, okay? Deuteronomy says the sins of the fathers pass on to the third and fourth generation. And so people felt predetermined. Like, they felt like, if my father was a sinful man, then it does me no good to make a different choice because God's upset with me no matter what. I can't do anything. Yes, he sinned before I was born, but I didn't have anything to do with that. But nonetheless, God holds things against people for generations, and I am not empowered to make a different choice. Ezekiel is changing all that, and he's saying, no, I've got a different revelation of God, and I'm telling you, you're not allowed to say, my father ate sour grapes, and that's why my teeth are set on edge anymore. I am not going to do that. See, sometimes common sense is helpful. We wash our clothes after we wear them. Helpful. We wash our dishes after we eat on them. Helpful. We bathe once a day. helpful, right? Sometimes common sense loses the plot. Everybody gets wasted on the weekend. Is that true? Pretty much. Does that mean you should? No. Sometimes common sense is helpful. Sometimes common sense is disempowering. And in this culture, in that day, the common sense was, if my father was evil, no matter what I did, I couldn't overcome it. So why not just live evil and then perpetuate evil and then perpetuate evil? Ezekiel's like, no, that's how we got here, is because no one stood up to what we knew to be true and right and lovely and of good report. Nobody did it because they felt disempowered. God doesn't want to hear your excuses one more second. You are not where you are in life because your father ate sour grapes. You are where you are in life because of the choices you are making. He keeps going. Watch this. Next one. For every living soul belongs to me, the Father as well as the Son. Both alike belong to me, but the soul who sins, that's the one that will die. In other words, the question is never who belongs to God and who doesn't. If people are breathing air, they belong to God because God's holding them together by the power of his name, and he loves them. Paul said it this way, that he's filling everything in every way. The question isn't who belongs to God and who doesn't. The question is who will choose to live in God's ways and who will choose to turn from it. And those who turn from it, they're going to find their life in disrepair. And those that accept it and surrender their life to it, they're going to find their life in peace and abundance and wholeness. The question isn't who belongs to God and who doesn't. The question is who will make the right choice. Now, keep in mind that when Ezekiel was writing this, common knowledge of the day was something called generational curses, right? So if your father sins, then you have no choice. You're under judgment, and then they're under judgment, and then the next one's under judgment, and then the next one's under judgment. That's how they were interpreting those scriptures. Ezekiel's like, that is not empowering. So he makes this incredible case, and he tells this long story that I don't have time to read. He tells this long story about a righteous father who then had a wicked son, who then had a righteous son. So you have a righteous grandfather, a wicked father, and a righteous son. And his question is, in that situation, who pays for what, right? You got a righteous guy, and his righteousness evidently didn't pass to the wicked guy. But then you're going to make a case that the wicked guy's wickedness passes to the righteous son. That is a disempowering thing. No one will ever win. And he makes this incredible, compelling argument that every generation has the opportunity to stand on its own 2 feet before God and choose to eat fresh fruits instead of sour grapes. And here's how he ends the argument. Check this. He will not die for his father's sin. He will surely live. He's talking about the righteous grandson. He's like, the righteous grandson is not going to die because his dad was evil. Now remember, in that day, that's called heresy. That's like, wait a minute. Scripture says something different. Ezekiel is reinterpreting the scripture to be empowering. Watch what he says. But the father will die for his own sin, because he practiced extortion, robbed his brother, and did what was wrong amongst the people. Yet you ask, why does the son not share the guilt of the father? Remember, that would have been common knowledge. Wait a minute, Ezekiel, you're saying something new. Why does the son not share the guilt of the father again, right? Since the son has done what is just and right and has been careful to keep all my decrees, he will surely live. Keep going. The soul who sins is the one that will die. The son will not share the guilt of the father, nor will the father share the guilt of the son. The righteousness of the righteous man will be credited to him, and the wickedness of the wicked man will be charged against him. Now watch this. But if a wicked man turns away from his sins, and he's committing, and keeps all my decrees and does what is just and right, he will live and not die. I love that. In other words, no matter how far down the road of death, darkness, and decrease you get, you're one decision away from turning around and joining the ranks of the life, light, and increase. I don't care where you are or what you've done or where you've come from. You are, if you're within the sound of my voice right now, you are not too far away from God to make a decision and start really living life again. You are not. It's not because your father ate sour grapes. I want to squash that excuse this morning because that excuse will destroy you. You are where you are in life because of the decisions you have made. And it's time for you to take responsibility and turn around from the things we've been rationalizing and start really living again. It doesn't matter how far down the road of death, darkness, and decrease you get. You are one decision away from turning it all around and getting back into life, light, and increase. Now watch, he keeps going, watch. None of the offenses he's committed will be remembered against him. Because of the righteous things he's done, he'll live. Do I take pleasure in the death of the wicked, declares the Lord? Rather, am I not pleased when they turn from their ways and live? In other words, God is so happy when people turn their life around. He is not sitting in heaven watching people destroy themselves going, ha, 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 watch this. No, 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 no. He is pleading with them, sending messages to them. He's pleading, urging, filling, please turn your life around. It pleases the Lord when people turn their life around and truly live instead of in disrepair, they live in wholeness. No, watch what he keeps going. Watch. But if a righteous man turns from his righteousness and commits sin and does the same detestable things the wicked man does, will he live? No, none of the righteous things he's done will be remembered. Because of the unfaithfulness, he is guilty, and because of his sins he's committed, he will die. Now understand, he's not talking about heaven and hell here, nor is he talking about permanence. It's the same metaphor. Essentially, it's this. No matter how far down the road of death, darkness, and decrease you get, you're one decision away from turning around to life, light, and increase. But no matter how far down the road of life, light, and increase you get, you could live for God for 50 years, and that doesn't excuse you to do 20 years of wickedness to overcome and balance the scales of 50 years of righteousness. That will ruin your life. So no matter how far down the road of death, darkness, and decrease you get, you could turn around and start down the road of life, light, and increase. But the life, light, and increase road doesn't have a bank account that builds up over time. You start acting like an idiot, and it will destroy your life very, very quickly. The idea is every single day wake up saying yes to the infinite possibilities that the Spirit of the risen Christ has for us. Continue to say yes. Paul said it this way in Colossians chapter 2. He says, just as you received Christ, so continue to walk in him. Everybody receives Christ a little bit different way. But what's true of all of us is that we responded to God. No matter what you did, something happened and you responded. Paul says, if you want to live a Christian life, here's how you live a Christian life. You keep responding. You keep saying yes every single day of your life. He keeps going. Watch this. Yet you say the way of the Lord is not just. I know this is going to surprise you, but there were some people who didn't agree with Ezekiel's thing because it went against Deuteronomy, right? Jesus said, you don't need to sacrifice animals anymore. We'll do one sacrifice for the whole world for all time. And people didn't like that either, right? So sometimes when you have the nicer revelation of God, people will resist you, right? So he says, the way of the Lord is not just. Hear, O Israel, is my way unjust? Is it not your ways that are unjust? If a righteous man turns from his righteousness and commits sin, he'll die for it. Because of the sin he's committed, he'll die. But if a wicked man turns from the wickedness he's committed and does what is just and right, he'll save his life. Obviously metaphors and obviously not permanent. If you're going this way and you turn around, you'll save your life. If you're going this way and you turn around, you'll start destroying your life. If you go this way and you turn around, you'll save your life. If you go this way and you start acting stupid and you turn around, you'll destroy your life. These things are dynamic, not static. Now watch what he keeps going. Watch this. Because he considers all the offenses he's committed and turns away from them, he will surely live and he will not die. Yet the house of Israel says, the way of the Lord is not just. Are my ways unjust? Is it not your ways that are unjust? Keep going. Therefore, O house of Israel, I will judge you, each one according to his ways, declares the sovereign Lord. Repent, turn away from your offenses, then sin will never be your downfall. Now watch this if you've tuned me out. Watch this is like Ezekiel genius stuff. Rid yourselves of all the offenses you've committed and get a new heart and a new spirit. Why will you die, O house of Israel? For I take no pleasure in the death of anyone, declares the sovereign Lord. So where does that leave us today? A couple of thoughts on this. One, you honor people because you're honorable, not because they are. The best way to honor your family line, particularly your father, is to choose today, as for me and my house, we will serve God. And when you do that, people look at your life and they assume that you come from a godly line, even if you don't. My great-grandfathers were illiterate Ku Klux Klan members, moonshiners, I don't know how to say it in Afrikaans, rednecks, Flufovsk. No, I don't know what you said. Anyway, Palookas. My great-grandfathers were, quite frankly, horrible people. And education never really came into our line. In my generation, there was 26 grandchildren. Only six of us graduated from high school. Only two of us went to university. That was me and my brother. But when you look at how my brother lives and you look at how I've chosen to live, people look at our family line and they assume, hey, you come from really, really... One person asked me one time at my table, they said, do you come from a long line of preachers? No. But that's what I'm talking about. When you choose to change your life, people look at what's in front of them and they assume it's all the way back. The best way to honor your family is to live the life now yourself. A couple of thoughts I want to leave us with this morning. Next one. All of us are shaped by our history and heritage. No question about it. How you think about purity or promiscuity come from your family of origin. No question. Your default button on how you handle stress comes from your family of origin. Some people get calm and quiet. Some people do not. That all comes. We all learn how to handle those things from our history and from our heritage. Our default buttons are set in our personality by 8 years old, and we learn it from our family of origin. No question about it. Two, we must take responsibility, though, and repent and live. Like all of us have things in our family line that need to carry on. Like, my father gets up every day at 4:15 and prays for me until 5. And once a week, he'll send me an email with all the blessings he spoke over me that week, with the things he's believing God for me. My dad's prayer discipline needs to carry on to the next generation. But his tendency to scare the crap out of people needs to stop. It needs to cease. His tendency to invoke fear in people this big, that probably needs to stop. And it doesn't dishonor him to stop that. It actually honors him because by the time he's dead and gone, grandchildren and great-grandchildren will be living better and better and better and better. The idea is that all of us in our family trees have stuff that needs to carry on, and all of us have stuff that needs to cease. Moses said it this way, honor your father and your mother that your days will be long in the land. It has nothing to do with long life. It has everything to do with how long you're going to live in God's ways for your life. And he says this. He says, you know what? Here's the deal. Here's the deal. When you're brave enough to end family patterns that don't bring life, light, and increase, and you're brave enough to engage in family patterns that do, watch what happens in the longevity of the godliness of your family tree. Watch what happens when you truly honor your father and your mother. And here's the truth of it. Every one of you today, including myself, we have been rationalizing something in our life. We're rationalizing today and we'll regret it tomorrow. Like right now, you and your spouse, you're probably thinking silently, "Ooh, we probably should cut that out. Oh, you know what? All that yelling and screaming, our children are learning from that. We probably should stop. We should probably, you know what, we learned it from our family of origin, but we have an opportunity today to change our family tree. And here's the thing, if you take that opportunity, you will change your family tree. If you don't, your children will have to. Why put that on them? You change it today. And four generations from now, you'll be dead and gone. But the fourth generation will look back and go, my great-great-grandfather, man, he was the hero of our entire family. Let's say it this way, last one. When we choose to live God's ways, God gives us a new heart and a new spirit. And this is where Ezekiel, to me, is so genius and so revolutionary. Because here's what I've heard so many times in my life, and it's so disempowering. Here's what I've heard people say. Shane, I need to get healed from the hurts of the past before I can start behaving properly. It goes something like this. If I could just get healed from what happened to me, then I could start behaving in a better manner. If I could just get healed from what happened, then I could start behaving in a better manner. And here's the problem with that. Some things you can't be healed from. Some divorces are so devastating. You want to get healed from that? Some violations are so deep, you want to get healed from that? Nah. Some things you just can't be healed from. And here's the beauty of Ezekiel. Ezekiel says, God is not interested in healing your broken heart. God is interested in giving you a brand new one. Why would you want a fixed heart when God is offering you a new heart? And here's what Ezekiel says that empowers you. He says, if you by faith choose to live in God's ways, you're going to find that a new heart and a new spirit is going to take care of itself. One way says, get healed and then you behave right. Not Ezekiel. Ezekiel says, by faith behave right and watch what'll happen. The new heart and the new spirit is on its way. You don't want a healed heart. You want a brand spanking new one. I bless you, my brothers and sisters of Pretoria East. I bless you to be people who are brave enough to change your family tree starting right now. I bless you to be people who honor your father, whether he was good or whether he's not good. Honor him because you're honorable. And the best way to honor him is to change your family tree today. I'd like to pray for you. If you're sitting next to your spouse, I'd like you to take her or him by the hand, whichever one, right? This doesn't exclude people without spouses. I'm not married, and it doesn't exclude me either. There's a reason I'm doing this. I want us to get quiet before the Lord and cancel the white noise, and I want you to pray this prayer underneath your breath, not in a way that points you out, but just underneath your breath. Lord, give me the courage to see things different and the irresistible urge to respond to what I see. Lord, give me the courage to see things different, the irresistible urge to respond to what I see. And right there underneath your breath, I want you to ask this question with both of you. What are we rationalizing in our family today that we will regret tomorrow? Are we rationalizing something that our children will be tempted one day to say, it's my father that ate sour grapes? And may we make a decision together to cease that? Why don't you just be brave enough to say, Holy Spirit, is there anything we're rationalizing today that we will regret tomorrow? And why don't you just now, before the Lord, make a commitment to at some point this week, sit down with a cup of coffee with your spouse, no judgment, no anything like that, but say, you know what, sweetie or hubby, do we need to make changes here? Are we living an honoring life? If you're here today and you've never received what Jesus did for you before the foundation of the world, I would urge you to respond to Jesus right now. You can know if God's knocking at the door of your heart. You could simply, if you need a prayer to pray, you could pray something like this. Lord Jesus, I'm choosing to trust your version of my story instead of the one I've written for myself. I'm going to surrender to that. And I'd love to partner with you. Change this world. Why don't you make that decision now? Would you look this way? My brothers and sisters, be the heroes of your family tree. Eat fresh fruit and never sour grapes. It's not because your father ate sour grapes that your teeth are set on edge. Make better choices.